Session number 20304, Reel 3.
Mr. Clark, Reel 3.
Well, I said that we were going to relieve the 56 London Division, the old Black Cats, and we concentrated in an area, and we were shipped up to the Anzio town. That had been knocked about considerably, you know, during the original landings. And we concentrated in an area which was right by, in a pine forest on the coast, which was quite reasonable. And during that period, of course, they were sorting who's going to go where and what was what. And Anzio Annie, as he was called, or she was called, used to shell us. But there was, I believe it was said that they had this huge gun a long way the other side of Rome that they used to bring it out of a railway tunnel like we had over here, you know, and bang a few rounds into Anzio town or anywhere within the in the Allied area. And at first, expedition into the fighting area, there was different places. One called the Fortress, one called the Lobster Claw. The Fortress was the worst place of all because it was practically surrounded by the Germans. I just remember that this particular part of the beachhead was all nullahs or gullies, you know, steep sides, wet at the bottom usually. There was, when we were going up through these nullahs, the signallers, various people, they put all the wires, you know, they kept being broken by shell fire, so, you know, instead of trying to find the break, they would put another line in. Of course, as you march along, your rifle on your shoulder and catching one of these wires, and it wasn't a pleasant sort of... Anyway, the first position we got into, it was quite open. You remember there was a farmhouse there, and about four or five cows, all bloated, lying on their backs with their legs sticking up. I remember that. Then we went out at night and put some wire up, sort of First World War type thing, you know. Put the pickets in the ground and strung the wire, dammit wire, the big coiled stuff. And then we moved, the C Company moved into the fortress. Now this is where I get very confused with when and what happened. I don't know whether you've seen the official photographs, have you?
Probably, but don't worry about those because we can't do anything visual anyway.
No, but I would like to look at them presently. I did get them out somewhere. Yes, the forward positions again. These, instead of being on the forward slope, because they were on the rear slope. Germans are sitting on the top, and they could shoot down. Literally, you'll see one of those photographs. They had knife edge wire. In other words, they put it on cross wood, strung it along like that, not like our dannet wire in coils. Yeah? And you can see it about 25 yards away, and they were just behind that. And they used to, in that particular position. If you put a tin can, like your, as I said, steak and kidney pudding you'd eaten out of the tin cold, you put it on the top of the trench and shoot it off. Yeah? I mean, you couldn't move during the day, so any you know, normal functions, you did in a tin can and tossed it over the over this. It was typical First World War sort of trench warfare. We were in and out of those sort of areas, you know, about, did about 7 days sometimes in, and then out again. Somebody would relieve us, one of our own sister battalions in the brigade, like Inniskilling Fusiliers or the Wiltshires, you know. And that was a very frightening time, really, because they used to use, and you know what a Nibblewerfer is, do you? The six-barrel rocket or mortars, we used to call them. And they used to all the time, well, they could pinpoint, you see, because they were on the higher ground, and they knew where our trenches were. And they used to, we had a lot of casualties from those splinters, shell splint, well, mortar splinters. So there was nothing sort of desperate until it was decided that for some reason somebody, I suppose the divisional commander, we better not put that in. Oh, sorry. he said, be aggressive, you know, all this rubbish. So C Company were going to do a raid through B Company's position, you see. So we got together and they issued us with Bakelite grenades. can't remember the number there now. But these were to create noise and confusion, you see. I mean, if you put a 36 Mills bomb, as they used to call them, you know, I mean, you get all the all the metal flying about. So they issued us with Bakelite grenades. Anyway, we moved up behind B Company. They were up on one of these hills, one, not hills, but up the... And somebody decided that they ought to have smoke. So the artillery put down the smoke, and it didn't go where the right place. It fell amongst us, of course, didn't it? So we were choking with smoke. And then there was a kerfuffle. One of our platoons had gone up to go through on this patrol, you know, to be aggressive. And they found that B Company's positions, there was nobody there. And what happened? The Germans had decided on a raid at the same time, and the whole of B Company disappeared eventually. In fact, I can show you, there was only 9 men came out of that, wounded, killed, and most of them went in the bag, B Company. And then eventually So the raid was called off, it was useless, so we went up and took over B Company's positions. And as I said, it was very near their wire, and every morning and evening stand to, it was so to fix swords in the Cameronians, not bayonets, swords. And of course we always used to make sure he heard, slap him on him, nice metallic sound, so he knew that we were fixing bayonets. Dusk and dawn. My favourite method of sleeping. We had, as I said, we had a great coat, one blanket. And normal equipment. And to sleep at night, I used to unbuckle my equipment, undo my greatcoat. I still had my gas cape on, of course. Then I'd pull the blanket up, right up round my waist, right down over my legs, like that, and round. Do up my equipment and greatcoat again, pull the gas cape round so it went right down my similes, small pack behind my head, rifle down by my side with a breech cover on because of the mud and the rain. And then I used to flop down like that and sleep like that. So that I was fairly well covered from the seepage from the ground underneath and any rain on top. The tin had over my eyes.
Could you get to sleep?
Oh, yes. Usually tired out. You see, if you remember, we're still very short of men those days. Going back to that B Company thing, I said there was only nine of B Company left. And I the Air Intelligence Officer at the time, he wrote an article in the Covenanter and was reminiscing about their war diaries at the PRO, yeah. And he got a copy, and he wrote to me. I wrote to him and said I remembered in this particular instance. He said, the battalion, on that during that week that we were up in the fortress, that we suffered 258 casualties, I think it was. He said the most the battalion had suffered since Dunkirk. Oh, sorry. So you see, and I, of course, B Company disappeared entirely for the time being. And we came out again, and we had a new officer. And they said, you will be his Batman. So I was a Batman. We went.
How did you feel about that?
Horrible. No, I didn't want to do that sort of job. This was when we used to go back to this pine forest. I told you about the sandy, nice sandy. And anyway, he is quite a nice. In fact, I was older than him, I think. He'd only just been commissioned. And anyway, we went back into the fortress again. And what used to happen? They used to, so many of each company would be left out of battle, LOB, yeah. And probably the either say anti-tank platoon or the carrier platoon, they would form the carrying parties to bring up the rations, you see, in sandbags and the water in cans. And I used to have to go sometimes, because I was the officer's servant, I was a sort of platoon runner, you see. And I used to know my way down these gullies because the ration parties used to dump the rations and they didn't bring them up to the platoon headquarters so that we could distribute them to the forward sections. And I got to know my way down the gullies and where to turn, because I used to turn right where there was a whole arm and shoulder blade out of the ground with a khaki sleeve on it. This was because people were, when they were killed or wounded, and they were buried just on the spot. Anyway, this particular time, I brought the rations up. And they decided it was a great idea to have freshly baked bread. And this was going to be in the form of rolls. And of course, they didn't put the rolls in the separate sandbags. They put them all in with the other tins. And by the time they got to us, they were just crumbly pieces of bread, which wasn't very helpful. The other incident, the platoon headquarters were dug in the side of the one of the gullies, and there was the officer, a sergeant, and a signaller, and myself in there. And at this particular night, we weren't doing anything, just sitting and smoking, I suppose. And somebody pulled there was a blanket over the entrance of this semi-dugout place. And it was one of the corporals from no, that's not right. I'll have to go back on that. The officer used to go and visit the forward sections. there was a white tape up the gully onto the rear side where the trenches were, and he used to visit them, of course, once a night perhaps. And he went up there one night. I said, "Do you want me to come?" He said, "No, you stay behind. I don't want." And the next thing we knew, this corporal from one of the sections, I can't remember his name, but it was Joe somebody, he pulled the blanket aside of the dugout and said, "I've got the stretcher bearers here." I said, he said, "Lieutenant Black's been wounded up on my section, on top of one of the trenches." I said, "Well, how in the hell did you get here?" He said, "I walked all along the top and got to Company HQ and came back all along the gully with the stretcher bearers." He said, "I can't find my way back up there." So I said, "All right, I'll take you up." And we climbed up the side of the gully, and then they started mortaring us because they must have heard a sound. And the stretcher bearers went forward, and I tried to point out where the trenches were. Joe went forward with them, and what had happened, the lieutenant, forgot his name, Black, he was obviously leaning on the top of a trench, talking to the men in the trench, and the Germans probably had a spandau on a fixed line, and they swept the area backwards and forwards and caught him right across the stomach. Anyway, they got him, he actually tried to crawl, and they semi-dragged him, got him on a stretcher, took him down the gully. I put all his small kit behind his head, and they took him off. But he died of wounds before they got him back, I think, to the regimental aid post. And this is, of course, what happened practically all the time. Officers were in very short supply. Now the next, we went back frequently into these different positions, but the next one was what was called the 3 week position. We were there for 3 weeks, and this was right on the, almost on the coast, near the Mileta River, and you could see the sea, and it was masses of sand dunes. And we stayed there for 3 weeks. It was supposed to be a quiet place, which it was, I suppose, in comparison with the others. And one incident that stands out in mind, there was a forward position that was manned by two men in a slip trench, no movement during the day. And one evening, there was shelling and mortaring, of course, a normal sort of thing. And one evening, somebody went out to take them some food or relieve these two. It was a corporal. What was his name? Bob, Big Rob. Can't think of his name. But the other chap was Skipper Graham. And they were both dead in the trench. And it was a fantastic thing, really. Both their steel helmets were pierced with a tiny shell splinter. Both of them, yeah. And it couldn't have been more than an eighth of an inch hole in the steel helmet. Went right through their heads. When we buried them, well, they were taken out and they were buried on the... sort of in the rear area where these trenches were. fantastic that is, really. That's the tiniest splinter. Two men. I can't think of any. We did a little bit of patrolling there, but not much. You just walking about on the sand dunes, but there was no, nothing. As I say, it was a quiet position. And after that, one thing I did remember was on these approach marches to the fortress area from the rest area, we used to pass the marshy area, and if you remember, Churchill said that Mussolini was the bullfrog of the Pontine Marshes. Well, that was quite true, because as we marched through there, the croaking of the frogs in the evening, fantastic noise. And there was also, we always knew when we were getting close to, you know, getting into the trench sort of sister gullies, there was a dead donkey there and it smelt. Then I think, I don't remember, they opened a cinema in Anzio town. It was underground and sandbagged, and we went to see a film once. We had one bath and change of clothes at a mobile bath unit. Then the last time we went in, we actually went into the fortress again for the last time. And this, the great thing about the Allied troops breaking out of Anzio is a lot of rubbish, because they had spotter planes. We had spotter planes going up, and one morning that we were told that the Germans had just gone. We didn't fight our way out or anything like that. We just walked through. And their trench system was absolutely marvellous. The dreaded Nebelwerfers were dug in, I would say, in pits over 9 feet deep, and, well, were they 12 by 12? With all their ammunition wrapped in the sides, dug in the sides. And when we got to parts of their trench system, everybody was very wary about booby trapping. And we were to stay in their trenches, which I would say was through the lines now, right at the far side. And the engineers came up and they checked every bolt hole, because they were dug in the sides of the trenches. Very well made, riveted and everything like that. Nothing like our crumbly old things. And they checked for any booby traps. Now, I was telling you about the ration parties coming up and down. Well, they used a certain track all night, brought up ammunition and rations and things. And in the morning, we moved out to go further up towards Ardeer, I think. And we were just taking off. Let me think now. I was at the end of the, I don't know which platoon it was, might have been 14 platoon. There was a corporal, a private, and then our sergeant and myself, and I don't know who was behind, but the people had been using walking up and down there. And the corporal, his name was Hurst, Lance Corporal Hurst, he stepped on a mine, and people had been up and down that road all night, or up that path all night. He got his legs blown off. The man behind him, and his name was Geddes, he died actually of wounds. He was absolutely covered with shell splint or mine splinters or rubble. And the sergeant, he got hit in the stomach, and he said, they got me, they got me, they got me. I said, you're had he fall, undid his equipment, and a stone had hit him in the gut. Anyway, I don't know what happened to him, but he didn't appear back again. And then we went on up to the Tiber. I think A Company was in the lead at the time. There was nothing terrible about that. The Germans, they just, you know, they were well organised, they were withdrawing, they knew how to do it. There wasn't any fighting. And we got to the Tiber, and that's where we finished our Italian campaign. We went to Rome. The pipe band played in Rome a couple of times. And we had a leave in Rome, of course, a day's leave. And then they decided to withdraw the division for a rest. And we were taken out, gradually moved down Italy, and caught the boat at Taranto to go to, where we go to? Port Said. Disembarked there. Went up to a place called Muasca, which was a huge camp there, and very near the Sweetwater Canal, which was said that if you fell in there, you'd need 27 injections to keep the disease away. That, I think that's a slight exaggeration. Anyway, the whole division was around there, but when we, as I said earlier, that we were down to about five in a section, and in 17 Brigade, there was the Sea Force and the Royal Scots Fusiliers, and they amalgamated them, and they used this Muasca camp for a time, because they were so short of men, they'd suffered so many casualties, and they were queuing up for their breakfast one day, and they said, why don't they all mix together? They said, oh, well, they've amalgamated us when there's not many of us left. So they must have suffered quite a lot of casualty. And from there, of course, we were near Ismailia, and that was jolly good. There was the Blue Kettle, I don't think it was run by the YMCA, but some some organisation, lots of Italian prisoners serving ice cream, eggs are bread, so you had fried eggs and and beer, or horrible, what was it, Lazaiza, or Almaza beer. Anyway, it was a great change, and it was, you know, quiet, and the cinema was there, of course, open air cinema. Then we moved to one of these, I don't know which one it was now, it was Gaza Camp or Beit Lid. These were old, I think, First World War camps in a huge hutted arrangement. We did training, dashed up and down the Israeli hills, what there was of them, through the orange groves and all this sort of thing. But mostly it was visiting Tel Aviv, wasn't far away, and Nathania, a nice beach at Nathania. Went to Jerusalem. I had a leave in Jerusalem as well, apart from going there on a sort of day trip. Went to Baalbek. Oh, no, not then, but we did go to Baalbek. Went to Bethlehem. And then we moved to just outside Damascus in Syria. What was the name of the place? I can't think of that. Jebel Mazar. That's where it was. Jebel Mazar. There was a huge Jebel. Is a hill. Yeah. So they decided that we'd